Gonna rock these chains. Gonna scream my name. Make you shout now, honey. Gonna make you shout.
Whether you're an independent artist looking to take their career to the next level, or you're a fan that just loves to discover new artists and new original music, Making a Scene has exactly what you're looking for. For the indie artist, we have articles on music business, gear reviews, recording techniques, and interviews with industry professionals. For the fan, we introduce you to new artists every day with our in-depth artist interviews and insightful CD reviews. Nobody gives you more. Making a Scene truly is the number one resource for the indie artist and the fans that love them. Go to makingascene.org and become part of the indie revolution. And now, here's a double shot from our featured artist today, Elijah Marin. And stay tuned for that interview. It comes up right after these songs.
I wrote you a letter upon parchment paper, and I sealed it up with a kiss. Said to the postman, please carry it swiftly, so I'm not left feeling like this. Postman, he chuckled as his bag was buckled, and he took and drove off to the west. My letter to you, love, soon to be in your mailbox delivered. Although you are far, love, I can get there by car, love, if you give me a couple of hours. I'll make it there fine if I take 35, and I'll be at your door with some flowers. But money tight, babe, and rent has to be paid, and it costs a lot just to drive. Please accept my letter, we can read it together when I'm once again by your side. Fantasy, surreal as Renee. from the start, two lovers too far apart, a pair of two guarded hearts that we left ignored. Love is a luxury I thought I might never see, a passing fantasy.
Was Elisha Marine from his latest release, and we got Elisha on the line right now. Hey, Elisha, how you doing?
Hey, Richard, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you for coming on the show. I really appreciate it. Now, this is the first time you've been on our show, and we always give our fans an opportunity to get to know an artist by where they came from, the journey that they've taken. So give us the story of Elisha Marine.
My name is Elisha, and I am a musician, a visual artist, and a teacher. I love historic buildings, work a lot in the nonprofit field, and I'm releasing my first ever album on June 18th, 2021. It's titled Shining Out, and I have been a musician for, man, most of my life. I started performing on stage when I was 8 years old. And initially started performing in the Christian music world. My family was very religious growing up, which introduced me to some gospel kinds of styles, but not much else. And I found growing up that my songwriting style fell into what I'd later discover was the folk Americana genre. And I had been writing songs for a long time, performing them under my own name, and eventually got to the point where I had a catalog that we presented to Mr. Matt Patrick at the Library Studio in Minneapolis and put together an album that I'm really proud of.
Okay. Now, let's talk about that album a little bit. When you were putting this together, what was your goal for this? What were you looking to achieve?
So, the oldest song on this album is a decade old this year. And I had, you know, maybe 15, 20 songs that I'd been performing and people knew and had a following, but I never had the opportunity to actually sit down in the studio, sit down with a producer, session musicians, and go over the songs and really give them the attention that, you know, could take them to the next level. So the title track of the album is called Shining Out, and it's a song of hope. It's an optimistic song. It was written in response to the Charleston church shooting in 2015, which is a really, really tragic day in our, mm-hmm. our country's history.
Oh, yeah.
And I set that as the title song because it really features my heart in the album, which is humanity driven, hopeful. You know, I'm a hopeful romantic at heart, and you know, that album I think sets the tone for the rest. There are themes of heartbreak and new romance, you know. The ups and downs of life, but you know, my heart is to connect to people with my music, and I think Shining Out is really you know, the track that exemplifies that the most.
Okay, well, let's talk about you as a songwriter. Now, obviously, you have a lot of passion and what you want to write about, but you know, when you sit down to write, every songwriter has a way of tapping into that muse. What is your process when you sit down to write?
So I had the benefit working on this album of time, which I realize not everybody has when they are working on a record. Sometimes there's schedules and street dates that you gotta make. But I had no expectations for that. I allowed the inspiration to hit me when it came to me organically. A lot of songs on the album were written in one session with one stroke of inspiration. I love, you know, literature and metaphors, and I get kind of excited when I see a metaphor in the wild. You know, I see something that's like a literal reference that I think is really beautiful that I can capture and put into my songwriting somehow, which means that, you know, my songwriting has some layers of meaning to it, which I really, really enjoy. But most of these songs are autobiographical in some way. Most of them are literal in some way, taking something that is, you know, quite literal from my experience and, you know, turning that into a form of expression.
Okay. Now, you know, melody and lyrics are two different parts of the brain. You know, lyrics have that structure to it. It's a story. There's continuity. There's rhyme. There's meter. And it's a craft. The more you do it, the better you get at it. But melody is a little different. It's a different part of the brain. It's more ethereal. Some writers like to work off a groove and let the melodies to kind of free form out. Others like to work off the meter of the lyrics or a chord structure. What is your process that allows you to find your melodies?
I like to experiment. I oftentimes will come to the songwriting process with a concept in mind. And then I work on the lyrics and melody usually together. It's very rare that I'll have a set of dry lyrics first or a set of notes and melody that are independent of any thought or concept. I really view those two as being very connected. So I'll give you an example. Love is a Luxury, which is one of my favorite tunes on the album. It's a song written in reference to a painting by René Magritte, who is a Belgian surrealist painter. I mean, he could do photorealism like nobody's business, but the man had a sense of humor through some adverse life experience, which I find, you know, I take some inspiration from. And he has this painting called The Treachery of Images, which hangs in LACMA in LA right now, and it's a painting of a pipe, which is totally photorealistic, and underneath in little curly French script he has written "Ceci n'est pas une pipe," which means this is not a pipe. And one of my favorite things to do is to stand in that gallery and watch people 100 years later reacting to that painting, because it's not an actual pipe, it's a painting of one. But, you know, life is like that in a lot of ways to me. You know, there's layers of meaning in everything around us. So I had that painting just on my mind a lot. I had, you know, recently seen it at LACMA in LA, and you know, this concept of strong peep was really present in my head. And a close friend of mine, Suzanne Crane, an artist friend, came up to me one day and said, "Man, I had this dream. I dreamt that you sang this song that said something like, oh God, what was it? Something like, I love the sound of my language on her tongue, and I'm sorry, I can't remember much past that." And all of a sudden, when I heard those lyrics, when I heard her speaking them to me, they came into my head with some melody attached to them. And I said, "Thank you, I'm going to use that, if you don't mind." And I ran straight back to my studio and picked up an old 58 LGO, little mahogany guitar, and put a capo on and B flat, and the song came out. I picked a little something and started off with, I love the sound of my language on a tongue. And for some reason, the rest of the song flowed out of me almost in its entirety. So I do feel that there's a, I mean, if it's talking about the emotion or timbre or tone of a melody or a lyric, I feel that, you know, the emotional underlying structure lends some guidance for the songwriter as to which direction to take it.
Okay. Now, you know, a lot of songwriters have embraced technology. Some like to use their cell phone to capture those momentary inspirations. Others have a home recording studio and they lay out a structure and write to that, or, you know, allow themselves to utilize that to capture ideas. What are some of the tools you like to use as a writer?
I think I'm pretty old school in that regard. Pen and paper are really nice, and quite often I'll have little scraps of something scrawled down on a back of a receipt or a post-it. If they ever do get written down, you know, the cell phone voice memo tool is really handy when inspiration strikes you. And every, you know, you can take a little snippet of a lyric or a melody and really run with that. But most of it lives in my head, which I realized was not a great idea last August when I was involved in a pretty serious bicycling accident. It kind of struck home how fragile that you know, storing all of this information in just your head can be. So time to actually write things down. And I do think that there's a connection just psychologically when you take pen and paper and or pencil and paper, whatever your medium of choice is, and write something down, which is, you know, usually slower than you can speak it and quite often slower than you can actually type. But I think there's something in that intentionality. You know, when you can write something down physically, that can secure it in your memory or allow your other brain functions a little more time to process what you're actually writing.
Okay. Now, one of the things I think a lot of songwriters struggle with is the moment you put the pen down. You know, when is the song finished? And when do you allow it to go into production, allow others to put their fingerprints on it to create that sound? How do you determine that moment in a song's life?
Sure. And well, I think that songs do change even once they've been recorded. I mean, the only thing that you're ever really doing, you know, is in life is moving forward through time, and everything that you do is like leaving a little signpost of, you know, I was here, this is what I was doing. Every little bit of expression that you have has so much context with it. So even when it, you know, when you feel satisfied with a song, and, you know, it's just some kind of intangible feeling that you can get. For me, it's when the sets of lyrics are really tight and tidy, and, you know, you can't take a word away from a phrase without it sounding wrong, or you can't add a word to a phrase without it sounding quite right. There's a balance there when you can tune up the way a phrase is balanced, even, you know, musically. But once that happens, you can bring it to somebody else who can take that so much further or in another direction than, you know, one person alone could possibly do. And I found a lot of value in that. It was a huge learning experience doing it for the first time with Matt, but, you know, I had performed some of these songs for 8, 9, 10 years. The most recent song in the album, which was The Notice, I think was written within 4 or 5 months of recording, but that one also came out in 5 or 10 minutes of writing, and, you know, with a little tweaking to the lyrics to make sure that everything felt good. You know, you can really rely on another person's savvy or intuition or experience to move that forward. And that, you know, still doesn't mean to the end of the song's life or the song's process. You know, that song can still change over time, but I think as a songwriter, acknowledging that fact and still holding the song with an open hand, even when you have a produced version of it or when you've been performing it for a decade, that can still have a lot of utility.
Oh, yeah. I mean, songs always evolve, no matter, you know. You go out there and you're going to do it different each time, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you get into the studio, that's a whole nother environment. And you had mentioned that, you know, you worked with a producer and, you know, in getting the sound that you use as your identifier as an artist is a whole art form in itself. And a lot of artists struggle getting that sound. What was it that you did in the studio that allowed you to capture what you wanted to identify yourself as your sound?
When we initially approached the production, I actually went back to my visual art. I love anything that has to do with typography, poster design in particular. And before we even talked about microphones or any other aspect of the production, I brought my visual portfolio along and went through it with Matt. And I said, you know, the visual art that I do is rooted in some sort of tradition. I like making text that feels like it could have been around for 100 years, or sometimes incorporate some physical element into the digital process. And I love, again, when you can take that digital art and then print it and bring it back into the physical world. So we looked at some references in history through a historic recording process. You have to go through the quite literal approach of, well, do we want tape hiss on the record or don't we? And, you know, my philosophy on that was that if we can get something sounding really clean and sounding future-proof in some way, modern, crisp, clear, but also having characteristics that root it in some sort of tradition, and that's the path that we would take. So that went quite literally, historically, in some directions with an old 1930s Gibson Arch top, which I dug out and we played on the Notice, paired that up with an old Dobro. You know, Respite Baby has both the blueberry microphone, which is a very articulate, very crisp, well, still sibilant at times microphone, and we tracked in tandem with an old CB mic that gave kind of a crunchy, you know, more retro, like overdriven feel to the song. We took that approach in the instrumentation as well. Aaron Fabrini did a really, really beautiful job playing upright bass as well as electric bass on the album. You know, Zach Miller, even in his choice of what drums or toms to bring to the studio, I had no idea that there was just so much variety in tone depending on the shape or the heads or the cymbals that you have, and how that really impacts the final feel of the song. So there are some retro inspiration that you can feel from it, but I do want the album to sound timeless, not like it's plucked from the 60s or 70s, and maybe not even like it's from 2021, but
okay.
Yeah, more,
now, you mentioned a couple of the players. What is the full lineup on this?
Sure. So Matt Patrick, who produced and engineered and recorded the record, is playing. I think he has, Richard, maybe 20 instrument credits on the album. Matt actually runs a little show on his Instagram page at Library Studio, called Unusual Instruments, where he walks through some of the, you know, really, really strange gear that he's got, and he broke some of that out. There's an instrument which he has deemed the guitar writer, and it has a Japanese name to it, but it's played with keys, and it's kind of dulcimer, kind of a typewriter mix. He plays electric guitar, dobro, harmonica, pump organ, all these things on there. Aaron Fabrini, who is a really, really genius session player out of St. Paul, is on upright bass, electric bass, and on Love is a Luxury, in particular, lent a really, really beautiful pedal steel solo. And Zach Miller brings up percussion. He's on all sorts of really amazing auxiliary percussion as well. Matt set up his studio kind of like a musician's playground. We showed up and tracked most of the beds for the album in a day. So I'm talking like six songs we tracked in maybe 7 or 8 hours. And every instrument was wired up. Every instrument was mic'd. And Zach listened to the song a few times, through compose, and then switch instruments and go add some flair to that. But in addition to that, I also have Alyssa Klein, who flew up from Nashville to sing on a few of those songs. She's featured especially on Stone Heart of Mine and USPS. And then shining out the very end of the chorus has the voices of about 100 students and some of my friends who gathered around microphones in the library studio or in the classroom and sang on the chorus as a big choir.
Okay. Now, of course, once you get this done and recorded, you have to create a team to help you create the buzz, get it out there to radio and to press. And you're working with Krista over at Tinderbox Music. Tell me a little bit about how that relationship began.
Sure. Yeah, so Krista was a reference from my producer, Matt, who goes with Krista for everything that he does. And Matt has worked with some of my favorite artists in the Midwest. And, you know, Krista does work all throughout the Midwest as well. Has worked with Lizzo and Jeremy Messersmith and, you know, a lot of the people who keep Minneapolis and the Midwest pretty entertained. So I was pretty lucky to get to partner with Krista on this.
Okay. Now, you know, the music industry has changed over the last 20 years. The digital revolution has redefined it several times over. And one of the things that has happened as we move through this digital revolution and now into streaming is that the consumer's perception of recorded music has shifted from a product to a service. They no longer look at recorded music as something to purchase anymore. It's available on their phone 24/7. They can pretty much listen to anything that was recorded in the last 100 years at the flick of a finger. How has this shift in consumers' perception of music affected you as an artist?
Yeah, well, what a time to be releasing your first distributed work, you know. First having to wait through 2020, with two postponed releases, and now looking at June 2021. You know, this is a rapid shift for the music industry, but, I mean, you think about the history. You mentioned songs going back 100 years that are now available for streaming. You know, before recorded music, you were listening to a group of people physically performing a service for you every time they played. And music was viewed as a service. Quite often historically, even with the printing of music books. I think back to Stephen Foster, who wrote and had his works published. You know, that the melodies were treated really as a service more than a commodity. So I think this is part of a pendulum shift in the music industry. You know, we have had established models that are being turned on their head, but I really don't feel like this is anything new in a broader historical context.
Okay. You know, the pandemic has shut down touring for the last year and a half, and we're just now getting back into it. But during that time, artists had to find ways to stay connected to their fans and expand their fan base. Some did live streaming, some did content creation. Social media became really important to the independent artist as a way to connect to their fans. What were some of the things that you did during the pandemic that allowed you to engage your fans and expand your fan base?
Mm-hmm. The entire last year that we went through was all about digital and streaming and social media. And I had the added benefit of being the president of an arts nonprofit in southern Minnesota, and we shifted pretty early to doing live streaming. We had virtual open mic nights, which, you know, Richard, you can have like maybe a couple hundred people in your gallery space for an in-person event, but you turn it live to the internet and you have an audience of, you know, millions. And, you know, we could have several thousand viewers for virtual open mic night and have, you know, friends from LA and Nashville and be send it to our gallery. Whereas that, you know, just isn't possible physically. So I, you know, did some social media stuff, some live streams, a few performances that worked out fine. But really, when you can, I think, tie that to other musicians and introduce some collaboration there, I just always think that takes you further than you can go alone.
Well, you know, it's interesting because, you know, prior to the pandemic, live music was struggling to begin with. There were several generations of potential music fans that really didn't have a frame of reference to going to an intimate venue and watching musicians on a stage creating music in the moment, you know, and creating music that wasn't exactly like the last performance. They would go to the large stadium shows. They would hear music that was exactly like the recording. That was the excitement was generated by costume changes and pyrotechnics and lights and choreography. But now with the pandemic, independent artists have infiltrated this world of social media and the internet, and they created this world where they're exposing, you know, the Gen X, the Gen Z, the millennials to this world of music in the moment. And they also created also a sense of celebrity, that reality show mentality, that now when these, you know, potential fans go past the marquee and they see that name on the marquee, they'll may recognize it from, you know, Facebook or YouTube or whatever. Do you think that this might help revive live music, you know, after the pandemic?
Yeah, well, if we're talking reversion to the mean, you know, I know that people are really itching to be able to go and do things safely again. And I think you really hit on a very interesting point, which is the interaction of celebrity with social media, where people can be micro celebrities in a total bubble that is completely separate from other industries, other even forms of media, people who are on TikTok that aren't on Twitter, that aren't on Instagram, you know, things like that. Looping back to, you know, how music is now viewed as a service, I think, you know, the way to move forward is connecting to your audience. I mean, what an incredible tool that we have, most of us, in our pockets now, our cell phone, where we can pick up and live stream and, you know, connect to somebody on the other side of the world and share our music. You know, I don't feel like the world that we see in the future is going to be entirely digital. I really do feel like when it's safe again, the leverage that people have gained over the last 18 months or so of building some online infrastructure, I think that can really be used to promote something that's tangible and physical in the future.
Okay. Now, as we come out of the pandemic and we start the book again, we're going to be getting a lot of those, you know, this number is no longer connected phone calls, you know, where these venues have dropped off the face of the earth during the pandemic. They just could not have survived. Rising out of the ashes, what would be your ideal venue that you would like to see emerge from this post-pandemic world?
Well, I'm working away on building that right now. I'm sitting in the old lobby space of a historic YWCA building that I purchased mid-pandemic, because it has a gymnasium space that is really beautiful. June 16th, actually, the lyric video that I filmed in there will be premiering of the title track of the album Shining Out. And it's a community-based approach. Per code, it can probably fit 300, 350 people. But as a model, we're doing some private and nonprofit public cooperation, which, you know, can tie our venue space to the venue spaces that are regional with us. And, you know, anything that can connect a musician to a venue, to an audience, that's just not like that one, like, you know, booker to show chain, but is a little broader than that, you know, where there's a network that you can tie into. And anything like that, I think, is pretty much my ideal.
Okay. Well, you know, I really appreciate you coming on the show and talking with us. And we're going to give everyone out there a double shot. You may want to kick back, relax, turn it up loud. Nah, let the neighbors get in on this. We're going to have some fun.
Honey, tell me that you want me to hold you sweetly. Whisper that you're lovely for all of your life. Until I pass on from this world, you'll still be my girl. Oh, oh, but even then, you'll still be my girl. I was waiting in love accidentally. I told you about my dreams. You told me that you know me. Chapter in your book, and I felt the same way too. Oh, oh, Claire, I felt the same way too. In life you never know. Oh, in love you just can't know till it's too late. You've made the right decision. What bothers me the most, sometimes you just can't know. Cause sometimes there just ain't a right decision. We both looked ahead, forgot all we said. Caught up with me, frightened with bad. I apologize. I'm so sorry, but you never seemed to mind. And I got so afraid that I ran off into the woods. You brought me back, and I came back for you.
Did you treat the doubter?
that I've got problems. You gave us all this free will, then you left us in a garden. If it's true that you know our endings from beginnings, you would have known we often gravitate to fruit that is rotten. Is it blood or is it wine? Oh Lord, is it yours or is it mine?
Whether you're an independent artist looking to take their career to the next level, or you're a fan that just loves to discover new artists and new original music, Making a Scene has exactly what you're looking for. For the indie artist, we have articles on music business, gear reviews, recording techniques, and interviews with industry professionals. For the fan, we introduce you to new artists every day with our in-depth artist interviews and insightful CD reviews. Nobody gives you more. Making a Scene truly is the number one resource for the indie artist and the fans that love them. Go to makingascene.org and become part of the indie revolution.